This is A Better Night's Sleep, a podcast about sleep, sleep disorders, and evidence-based treatments from military health sleep experts. I'm Dr. Julie Kinn with the Defense Health Agency.
And I'm Dr. Jonathan Olin, sleep physician and medical director of the Evans Army Community Hospital Sleep Lab.
John, in our last episode, you taught us about sleep apneas and how you diagnose them with in-lab studies and studies at home. Today we're going to talk about treatment, but before we get into that, can you please remind us about the different kinds of sleep apneas?
Sure. So obstructive is more common, and think of it as, frankly, an obstruction, kind of like a cork blocking a bottle. So there's actually a problem with a blockage leading to the person obstructive sleep apnea. When the person is asleep, they are obstructed and they're not able to move air. Generally, their tongue, their soft palate, their upper airway is collapsing and then blocking and interfering with airflow. So again, we earlier described that we don't demand perfection in the field. They don't have to be open 100% of the time throughout all sleep time when studied. But if that's occurring 15 or 30 times an hour, we'd call that, for more than 15 to 30, moderate obstructive sleep apnea. If it's more than 30, we call it severe obstructive sleep apnea by frequency of events. Central sleep apnea is, again, asleep, not moving air, but not an effort to breathe. And that's the brain not giving input to go ahead and breathe. That's common in some conditions. The conditions that are associated with central sleep apnea are broad, like obstructive sleep apnea is generally a blockage or is a blockage. Central sleep apnea, all of us, if you're in the Northwest, I'm in Colorado, if you take me to the top of Mount Rainier or I take you to the top of Pikes Peak, both of us are going to have central sleep apneas where we're going to hyperventilate because of the altitude and elevation. We're going to hyperventilate, and then our brains are going to go, oh, good, I got a good oxygen level. And as we drift off to sleep, we're not going to breathe. And then our brains are going to, oh, there's a problem. So that can be seen, for example, with elevation. It can be seen with medications, including, for example, narcotics or respiratory depressants, medications that decrease brain input to sleep. It can be seen with heart cardiac conditions like congestive heart failure. It can be seen with pulmonary conditions. It could be seen with neuromuscular conditions, for example, polio. I know that's relatively rare in the U.S. now. So the causes for why someone is not breathing are more complex than usually the causes with an obstructive sleep apnea, which is generally obstruction in the upper airway.
And it sounds like you might not even know that you're prone to this until you're deployed or having a permanent change of station to a place with a different elevation.
I mean, realistically, I think a substantial portion of us are going to have these central apneas at over 10,000 feet elevation. Certainly more people have them at Fort Carson, which is ballpark 6,000 feet, than, say, you know, Tacoma area.
Right.
Basically sea level. Is 6,000 feet, you know, absolutely where everyone has them? No, but they're way more common here. And there's a sleep lab at the Air Force Academy here in Colorado Springs that's another 1,000 feet, and they're more common, just additional 1,000 feet. So we're kind of teeter-tottering here at this elevation at 6,000 feet with more common, but not way, way common. And then think, you know, at 14,000 feet, basically everyone's going to have them.
I'm assuming the treatments differ for obstructive sleep apnea and central sleep apnea?
Sure. So central sleep apnea, you figure out what the cause is and then address that.
Okay.
If it's elevation, then they may need time to adjust. We try to avoid studying someone that just got off a plane and just arrived here, you know, 12 hours ago. So we're going to give them time to adjust. If they're on narcotics or medications, just had surgery or had a procedure, we're going to try to study them off of the narcotics or respiratory depressant medications. And then if they have ongoing central events, we can look at PAP, which is positive airway pressure, which can be useful. Sometimes for people, bleeding and oxygen can be useful, where they're getting some extra oxygen. And then there are special PAP-type machines that are useful for treating central apneas called ASVs. ASV, for example, is one type. There are specific treatments for central apnea, but in general, looking at why they're having the central apneas and trying to address that is useful and appropriate. But we should really talk about the more common condition, which is obstructive sleep apnea. So in general, you're going to try to somehow hold the airway open that's collapsing. So one way to do that is weight loss or weight control, if that's relevant and appropriate. So someone who is overweight by 10 or 20 pounds or 10 or 15%, if they lose weight, that may be helpful, especially lose some weight around their neck. There's obviously no way to specifically only lose weight around their neck or in their oral area, but avoiding gaining weight is going to be important. So weight loss, weight control is relevant for some. For some, not relevant. They're, you know, normal weight or underweight, and they still have severe apnea. PAP, positive airway pressure, where you're holding open a collapsing airway with air pressure. So if I break my finger, I know, Julie, you're, you know, we're doing this podcast not nearby, but if you were nearby, you'd could grab a pencil or a pen and, you know, some duct tape or something and splint it up, and we could go over to the ER and they'd look at it. But we could somehow splint or control it so it's not flopping around my broken finger.
Right.
So airway, obviously, much trickier airway area to splint. We can't tell people, hey, yeah, reach in the back of your mouth, pull your tongue forward, push your tonsils out of the way, now fall asleep. They're going to say, right, I'm going to throw up, never mind, you know, try to fall asleep. So one way to splint it, to hold it open, is actually with air and air pressure. So these are machines that pump air, and they'll get many different types of masks, and they're connected with a tube from the machine through the tube to the mask, and some of the masks go over just nose, and some of them just barely touch or kind of touch the nostrils, the opening, and will push in air, so holding open this airway that was collapsing.
So is it pushing oxygen in to replace oxygen from breathing less?
It's actually room air. So we're not pumping in in that oxygen only. It's room air that's being pumped in or that's using the room air pressure to hold open the airway. So we can't, that's actually a common thought is like, well, why can't I just put in a little oxygen like the nasal cannulas? You see those in, like, I don't know, medical movies or TV shows of like, I could just have some oxygen, that will help my obstructive apnea. And it may help it very, very slightly in the sense that your oxygen levels are slightly higher, but it's not doing anything to open the obstruction. It's just waving around higher concentration of air in front of the obstruction, not going to do anything to open the obstruction. So we need to do something to open the obstruction. So PAP sure can, and that's considered the gold standard. And for severe, that's going to be generally the treatment that's recommended.
Okay.
There'll be some people in a sleep study, either home or in lab, that have documented, say, severe or moderate sleep apnea when they're on their back, supine, and none or good breathing when they're on their side, lateral. If there's significant data for that, then positional therapy could be considered. And this is a person doing something in an organized way, not just saying, oh, my sleep study said I'm severe on my back, but they're going to do something in an organized way to make sure that they're not sleeping on their back. So that's going to be like body pillows, could be tennis balls sewn. This will sound a little weird, but tennis balls or pockets for tennis balls sewn in the back of their pajama top, and you put those in an X or a T, and you can sleep.
So that, you know, if you roll onto it, it's uncomfortable?
Exactly. So you train yourself to sleep on your side. Exactly. So why are people worse on their back? Because their tongue's generally flopping back and then blocking or closing the airway. So they do something in an organized way to make sure that they're not on their back. Surgery can be considered. There are multiple surgeries. The most common one is removing tonsils and some of the soft palate and the adenoids, the little dangly thing back there called the uvula. The statistics for that are not very, very encouraging in that under 50% of people get 50% improvement is what I've seen. And so it's generally not a first-line treatment. It could be something that is considered for people in the mild range for severe obstructive sleep apnea, some of these surgeries are not first-line treatments. There are other surgeries that are more aggressive, but people need to be thoughtful and discuss those, in my opinion, with an experienced ear, nose, and throat or surgeon before they do that. That's generally PAP is, as I said, the mainstay, quote, gold standard of treatment for severe. There are also, for mild obstructive sleep apnea, things called oral appliances or mandibular advancement devices. Mm-hmm. So it'll sound a little weird, but tongue, believe it or not, is attached to jaw. And if you do something with like a double retainer to advance jaw, even millimeters, you're pulling tongue forward millimeters and opening airway possibly millimeters. So again, for someone very severe, not a first-line treatment, but for someone with mild, the millimeters may be enough to then have effective treatment. I like getting follow-up sleep studies to prove that treatments are effective. If they had an in-lab study and we know they're good in various stages, mm-hmm. including REM on their side, then that's your data. But I like getting follow-up study with an oral appliance to show that it's effective and achieving good results.
Now, what about nose strips and devices for the nose?
Nose strips can be useful for snoring. There's not really good data that they're useful for obstructive sleep apnea. So it can improve airflow through the nose. So then there's less fluttering or less snoring as it going by the soft palate. But in general, the obstructions are in upper airway. And so improving some airflow from nose, it does not open the airway.
Okay, good to know. It sounds like there's a lot of different treatment options and that surgery is definitely not the first step.
Yeah, there are many treatments. I should say also with PAP, again, for moderate, generally considered the gold standard, for PAP, the machines now, they're increasingly modern. They're quiet. They're quieter than your household fan in general. They're relatively small. They're a little bigger than, they're like a small shoebox, and they have modems in them. So they track actually hours of use that the person's using it and events per hour. So it's, I think, interesting and fun for patients to be able to look at that data so they can track their hours of use, their events per hour. Is it as accurate as a full in-lab attended study? Yeah. No, because there's not a tech nearby. There's not all the wires. But we can look at how they're using it. The Army, I think the military, and the field in general consider adequate treatment more than 4 hours a night, more than 70% of the time. So in other words, 21 out of 30 days for more than 4 hours. And in general, mm-hmm. we like to see events per hour at less than 5, especially if they're, you know, moderate or severe. Sometimes if they have 100 events an hour and they're eight in there, and with the PAP, they're reduced to 6.0 events per hour. I might view that as pretty darn good. They're, you know, 94% improved. But in general, we like events at less than 5 per hour. So there aren't that many treatments where you can see how people are doing over a 30-day period, over a 60-day period. But this is one. And then hopefully we get patients and service members buying in and going, oh, wow, this is actually, I'm starting to feel a little better. Does take weeks often. I'm starting to feel a little better. My memory's a little better. My concentration's a little better. I've noticed my blood pressure might be a teeny bit better. People can get a lot of improvement with quality of life with improved sleep.
So can you take the PAP machine with you on deployment? Would having this kind of diagnosis and treatment make one unable to deploy?
No, that's a good question. So years and years ago, yes, you could not take it with you to deploy. Now you can. And in fact, it's encouraged. Mm. If someone has a knee condition and needs a knee brace, then we're going to say, yes, deploy with a knee brace. We're not going to ask you to ruck or to deploy and do significant time on your feet without your knee brace. And the same thing for sleep. So if they do need access to electricity, they may deploy with a battery pack, which is 8 hour, one night backup. It's not a 1 month supply of ongoing battery. They'd have to recharge it. So they do need access to electricity. I like people to have filtered air. What does filtered air mean? It means a room or some kind of enclosed container with a floor, four walls, and a ceiling. In other words, I don't like PAP just being set down, the machine being set down in a pile of mud. Even if they have a generator nearby, yeah, it's not going to do well for them or for the machine to be doing that. Yes, it'll keep your airway open for, you know, some of the hours, but it's going to break the machine or impact on the filters. So, but yeah, people deploy and the machines themselves will, again, track their use, track their data. But if someone has severe obstructive sleep apnea and then deploys and then is not with their machine and then is prone to falling asleep, that's dangerous. That's a problem. So the dangerous significance and consequences of untreated apnea are not just civilian. They can be military, obviously, also when deployed. So the Army would like people to, especially the people with symptoms, meaning daytime sleepiness, to be deploying with their PAP because we want them to be treated, want them to have better quality of life, better concentration, better attention, better focus.
I'm hearing that there's a lot of treatment options and that any sleep physician will be able to walk our listeners through them to figure out where's the best place to start.
Right. And it doesn't have to be a board certified sleep physician. Many of the PCMs are increasingly knowledgeable about sleep apnea, obstructive sleep apnea, and treatment options. So review this with a provider. They may consult or the person may choose to be seen by a sleep physician, but treatment's better than no treatment, and there are many primary care managers that are familiar with many of the sleep conditions and treatment options. Untreated sleep apnea is associated with high blood pressure, strokes, diabetes, and car accidents. And these, again, things tend to, again, normalize with treatment. Is it an emergency if someone misses their PAP for one night? No. But ongoing no treatment or non-treatment is a significant health concern and safety concern. So we do encourage people to follow up and get treatment for their sleep disorders.
That's a great reminder about the importance of this topic for our listeners and our loved ones. Thank you, John. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in. You can subscribe and rate A Better Night's Sleep on iTunes or wherever you get podcasts. A Better Night's Sleep is produced by the Defense Health Agency. You can get in touch with us on Facebook and Twitter @Military Health.